And good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your community radio station, KBOO. My name is Andrew Geller, and before we get to the heart of the show, I'm going to let you know that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Scanner, presenting the 19th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast, January 17th at 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. Tickets are available at The Scanner, and purchase deadline is January 14th. For information, the number is 503-285-5555, extension 554, or mlkbreakfast@thescanner.com. And just so you know, The Scanner is with a K, not a C. And also, this program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. More information is available at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Okay, housekeeping aside, thank you very much for tuning in this morning. Got a very dense show here for you today. My guest is Greg Leslie. He is the legal defense director for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. And I'd like to welcome you to our airwaves now, Greg. Morning.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And the reason that Greg is here today is we're going to be discussing primarily the contents of a fifth edition of a report, or actually a white paper, that RCFP has put out called Homefront Confidential: How the War on Terrorism Affects Access to Information and the Public's Right to Know. We're going to kind of use the report as an outline for the conversation and in a somewhat detailed yet rapid fashion, kind of get through as much of it as we can. It's extraordinarily dense and well-documented. I've seen earlier editions, and the fifth one is quite the accomplishment, so you're to be congratulated.
Thanks.
So I guess first, where did the idea for producing the report to begin with come from?
Well, we've done similar things in the history of the Reporters Committee. At various times, we had done similar kind of day-by-day chronologies of various administrations when there had been particular access problems or concerns that had come up. So once we knew there were going to be problems with any kind of, with all this information policy and misinformation and other access issues related to the war on terror, we realized we just had to kind of document it somewhere. And what we always try to do in these reports is get as much as we can on the record just to document things so then journalists or even citizens can take this and do more with it. So it doesn't try to necessarily arrive at conclusions and rank or grade the administration on how they're doing. We just try to present as much information related to information access and the right to know as possible.
And I suppose the most obvious reason, especially post September 11th, and that's really where this report focuses, is the war on terrorism. Although it could easily, just as easily, be argued that the first 8 months of the Bush administration showed a penchant for increased classification, increased secrecy, and reduced access to information. It's just post 9/11 they really ran with it.
Yeah, and it's not just the Bush administration. That was what was so striking about post-September 11th, is that suddenly people who seemed otherwise committed to openness started thinking, well, if we tell you where there's what the flaws are in the chemical production plant in your town, which information is useful to you if you're trying to protect your children or yourself from a possible disaster, suddenly officials are saying, well, if we tell you that kind of information about the safety risks, then terrorists will use that against you. And everything suddenly was being justified in defense of keeping it from terrorists. So there was a sudden kind of a sea change in the attitude about release of public information, of what had always been public information, based on the war on terrorism. And similar things started happening with access. We've heard of people who were out simply photographing a bridge or some other innocuous landmark and were told they'd be arrested, that that's now illegal because only terrorists are out photographing bridges. And there's a complete ban on photography in the New York subways for the same reason. They figure that terrorists would want to take pictures in the subways, so nobody should be allowed to take pictures.
So, yeah,
and the September 11th mindset is really what we're trying to get a handle on here.
Now, let's use that as a means to jump into the report. You do have a section called Freedom of Information, which more or less leads off with a memorandum that outgoing Attorney General John Ashcroft released not very long after September 11th. I guess it was maybe October.
Right.
So about a month following. And it's been known as the Ashcroft Memorandum, which, and you can fill in detail here, but it basically said to all federal agencies and employees, if you receive a Freedom of Information Act request and there is any legal reason that you feel like you can justify to not release the information, regardless of its, it being innocuous information, regardless of what it is, regardless of the reason, if you think you can withhold it, we're going to back you.
Right.
Now, the memorandum, I assume, is still in effect. And I'm curious if, A, there's more detail regarding the memorandum you'd like to fill in, and B, more broadly, what has the impact been in the course of the past 3 years that you've been able to find?
Well, it's there is some background that you need to know here. This didn't come out of the blue. Every time there's a new administration, and really every time there's a new attorney general, there's usually a memorandum issued on how FOIA policy will be enacted. Janet Reno had really surprised people by issuing a document that said quite the opposite of the Ashcroft memorandum, actually saying that unless you can find a reason why something should not be disclosed, it shall be disclosed. And so in a sense saying if there's that gray area where you're not sure, we're actually going to err on the side of releasing information. There had to be a clear reason to withhold information. So when the Bush administration came into office, we knew there was going to be some kind of memorandum from the Attorney General on how federal officials, particularly those in the Justice Department, should conduct FOIA policy, how they would enforce it. And so it was nonetheless surprising. It wasn't completely unexpected. I think it's not incredibly different than what had come before in the Reagan administration.
Was its timing curious in the sense that he waited for, most of the first year to release it, or is that really nothing at all?
I don't think that was unusual, because it does take a while for someone coming into office to get around to formulating a policy on information access. It's not going to be a front burner issue immediately, especially before September 11th. Access and information policy wasn't one of the things that you addressed first. And then the Department of Justice does take quite a while to get through drafting a policy like this. So I don't think that in and of itself was incredibly unusual that it came out after September 11th. In fact, because it came out in October, and because it takes such a long time to produce anything in the Justice Department, it's clear that this was the policy they created before September 11th.
Right.
Right. But so in the intervening time, it's been a constant subject of debate how much the memorandum has changed information policy. We certainly feel that it has encouraged more and more denials of access to information. Justice Department spokespeople talk about it being just a somewhat innocuous change. A change that would only affect the inner workings of the department and really doesn't affect access to information. So they're kind of defending their actions under the policy, saying it really hasn't been that bad of a problem. And yet, we really think, and there are no real hard and fast numbers on this because you just can't
get. I was about to ask.
What's that?
Well, that's what I was about to ask is, do they have anything that they can point to that supports that?
It's there are so few of the FOIA requests filed or even filed by journalists. Well, without knowing any hard and fast numbers on this, a lot of FOIA requests are actually filed by businesses. And so it's, there's no way to track how many requests for publicly valuable information made by journalists have been rejected or denied based on this memo. Also because a request to the Department of Justice or the FBI, which is under the Department of Justice, can take years to get fulfilled. So it's still something that there's no perfect way to statistically summarize what the effect has been. But, I think the culture within the Justice Department has certainly changed to one of doing exactly what the Ashcroft Memorandum called for, seeing FOIA as something that would be done only, release is almost the exception rather than the rule.
Now, I want to move on to a different part of the report, but just quickly, with Ashcroft's impending departure and possibly Alberto Gonzalez being confirmed as the new Attorney General, would you anticipate kind of a status quo and them not clamping down further on access to information? I'm just assuming that reversing Ashcroft is not going to happen. So
right.
What do you anticipate if Gonzalez is confirmed?
It's just hard to say right now. It would be hard to believe that he would do something that would reveal more of the Bush administration's secrets when he's been praised for so long as such a dedicated soldier within the administration. So it's hard to first put a peg on what his personal beliefs are, and then regardless of what those are, what kind of information policy he would impose on the department. So it's probably likely that the status quo will be maintained.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guest today is Greg Leslie. He's the legal defense director for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and we're discussing secrecy, information access, and public's right to know. It's all worked into a report they've produced called Homefront Confidential. You can find it and more information about RCFP on their website at www.rcfp.org. The People Rise Up website also has information on the topic, links to the report, and other resources from kboo.fm. So as we've ripped through half the show here and just been speaking about the Justice Department, I want to go back to actually the first chapter of the report, which seems appropriate to lead the report off, and a conversation, and that's the war. Not just the war on terrorism, but the actual military incursions that the United States has done in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and allowing having the military allow access to journalists. I didn't realize, because I've never really followed this as such, that the Pentagon completely, more or less completely, it seems, reversed its position from the first Gulf War or the Persian Gulf War to the invasion of Iraq regarding open access and how reporters were able to cover the battlefield. Can you tell us a little bit about how that shift has impacted the ability of journalists covering the war to actually tell an accurate story?
Sure. And I'd note first that it's been a controversial process. It's by no means an access win, hands down. The background here is that there was a lot of controversy after the Reagan administration's invasion of Grenada. And that started the media trying to make demands of the Pentagon, saying, listen, you've got to have a better access policy. And then talks continued through the first Bush administration with the first Gulf War. And access was better, but they still were not doing pooling and some of the embedding that we saw in this last action. And in the years after that, a group of journalists, primarily the Washington bureau chiefs for major media organizations, were meeting regularly with Pentagon spokespeople and drafting a media policy. And it kind of, without fanfare, that ended up being accepted, and that encouraged embedding when that was the only way to get access, but also release of the embeds once there was reason to believe they could travel on their own in a combat zone. But during the initial Afghanistan invasion, those rules were not followed. There was very little access for journalists, and anything they did get was just whatever they came up with on their own by going over there and trying to make their way along with troops. And so it really was only when there was the more formal act of invading Iraq that the Pentagon finally adopted the guidelines that had been talked about for over a decade and said, well, okay, we're going to create this program. We're going to train journalists on how to properly be embedded. So it was suddenly, it did appear to be a sudden out-of-the-blue sea change in their policy. Of course, the problem is that has not been without controversy. When you're covering a war from one side, and really your life is in the hands of the troops that you're covering, the argument has been by many people within and without of the journalism field that you can't quite be objective. So a lot of people see the embedding program as not much of a success because it led to misinformation. Others, and I think we would count ourselves in this group, is we did see it as a success because the government did allow access. Whether individual journalists may have compromised objectivity may be a problem, but allowing that access is a significant step and a big improvement. So it hasn't been without controversy, but we do think it's a big improvement in the way the government handles information access during wartime.
Now, in the context of sort of broadly available information about the Afghanistan and Iraq invasions, the Afghanistan military project, kind of on the face of it, as presented in mainstream media, if you didn't really investigate a whole lot, seems like it made a certain amount of sense. And the Pentagon didn't allow a lot of media access there. The Iraq invasion, created out of whole cloth, had a tremendous media presence before, during, and somewhat since, but not nearly as much as before and during. Seems obviously a Pentagon plan to restrict access to a situation in which they really sort of had to go almost, whereas the Iraq invasion was purely by choice, but that's the one they allowed a lot of access to. Any idea why that might have been?
The argument has always been fairly open that the government knows that it'll get better coverage of what its troops are doing if it allows access to those troops. I think those within the Pentagon know that reporters aren't out to get the military, in a sense. They know that once reporters are with troops covering them, they will cover them fairly for the most part. So the various branches of the military, and I can't speak to this personally, but the reputation has always been the Marines particularly, have always known that media access was a good thing. And they've encouraged journalists to either come with them on certain missions, or they've been good about their information policy. The other side of that coin is that they'll tell the story that they want the public to hear, and that's the part that'll be easy to report, and the reporters have to be a little more aggressive to get the entire story. But nonetheless, I mean, I think it's kind of easy to see, especially in retrospect, why they allowed so much embedding in the Iraq War. When they were going in, they saw this as a great, they were freeing the country from the rule of a dictator, and they wanted the reporters there to capture what they had been describing as the crowds that would be greeting their arrival, and they knew that embedding was the best way to get the coverage they wanted.
Okay. At the risk of an awkward segue, I want to jump to another section of the report, as we're running out of time, and at best we'll only get to half of the topics herein. And I think that this is probably the largest domestic impact in terms of reduced access to information, although there is a section in the report called domestic coverage. I feel as though that the issue of terrorism and immigration proceedings is actually a larger issue in terms of not being able to know really what's going on, as opposed to domestic coverage in general. Many cases, I mean, it ranges all the way from still not knowing how many people were arrested or detained or picked up and possibly not even heard from since post 9/11, all the way to deportation hearings. I guess there was a real quick post 9/11 change in terms of immigration hearings and whether they'd be public or not. And it's hard to say, well, which one of these has been worse? The coverage of the war and access to information, terrorism, immigration proceedings, Patriot Act, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what even to ask about this other than, you know, this, it's really bad. And how, you know, so.
Well, it has been surprising just how the idea of what we get to know about court proceedings has changed. And it is things like immigration proceedings, which presented a special case because they're not truly judicial courts. They're more of the executive branch courts.
But they used to be judicial, right?
Well, they weren't purely judicial. They were part of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So they're not what's they've always been non, you know, not purely judicial courts, in other words. I mean, they were part, they sprung out of the executive branch.
Okay.
And so that's why there were big cases in Detroit and in northern New Jersey over whether there was a right of access to those courts, because courts have held that, especially in criminal matters, and the Supreme Court has held this, that there is a First Amendment-based right of access to court hearings. And that always was based on judicial courts, truly judicial branch of the government courts. And it was not as clear whether that could jump to the administrative courts. And the circuits, the federal circuits hearing those two cases came out differently, and yet the Supreme Court chose not to resolve the issue. So there's still confusion there. But the Supreme Court itself has had to face some of the secrecy issues, where one of the people picked up after immediately after September 11th, and then soon found to be not much of a threat, apparently. But while he was still in detention, had actually brought a habeas corpus claim in federal court trying to get an answer to why he was being held. And his habeas corpus claim was treated as a completely sealed matter. And the guy's name, as we only learned through the work of a very enterprising Miami journalist, the guy's name is Mohammed Belahuel, and his case was treated as secret. It was even kept off the docket. And when he was appealing some aspect of it, and we still don't know what, but when he was appealing to the federal circuit, the 11th Circuit in Atlanta, that was also kept off the appellate court's docket. And then when it got to the Supreme Court, most of his brief had to be filed in secret. And the Solicitor General, arguing on behalf of the United States, sealed their entire brief. So there was nothing available on what the government's position was in this case. I should say that the proceeding before the Supreme Court was a petition to get them to review it. It wasn't a case they had accepted for review. So the Supreme Court denied the review in the case, but then never did unseal any of the documents. So it really showed a blueprint for how cases are kept completely secret, how cases can be kept completely secret and even off the dockets unless you really know what you're looking for. So that, I think that might be one of the most troubling secrecy issues to come out of all this is that the Supreme Court didn't seem to have much of a problem with secret dockets and secret proceedings and sealed files.
Now, as we're running out of time quickly here, and really doesn't make sense to try and get into another part of the report itself, aside from, say, being an advocate with an organization trying to deal with government documents or being a journalist, how can the general public best sort of fight the trend of secrecy and, you know, removing information from public access? I imagine the Freedom of Information Act and learning how to use it would be a good option.
Right. And the fight itself is kind of the solution, because these usually aren't people with evil intentions who are withholding information or denying access. They're reacting to new concerns and fears. And so when they encounter friction and they have to make a choice and they encounter more and more protest, I think slowly we'll see the evolution of these policies, and they will realize that when there's a public interest at stake and when the public is complaining about secrecy provisions, then there will be more of an effort to open up access to a lot of things that have been shut down in the last couple of years. So it's just getting involved and staying involved that can have the most effect, really.
And I suppose if that means nothing more than supporting organizations that do this kind of work because you don't have time to, that makes sense as well.
Sure.
Well, Greg, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to speak with us about this.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Greg Leslie is the Legal Defense Director for the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. You can find out more about them online at www.rcfp.org. RCFP is a voluntary association of reporters and editors working to defend the First Amendment rights and freedom of information interests of the news media primarily. Their report, Homefront Confidential, is available on their website. They have all kinds of other really cool resources on their site as well. So go check it out. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm also has a whole bunch of links related to information access, secrecy, Freedom of Information Act, that type of thing. You can send email to me if you have any questions, comments, or feedback about this or any other program at kboo@riseup.net. Next week, I'm not quite sure who the guest will be yet, but we are having an entire morning next Wednesday of inaugural, or as I'm calling it, the inaugural. I know it's a day ahead of time, but Barbara Bernstein's putting together a whole morning. This program will feature specifics of local to national and possibly even international activities specifically opposing the inaugural itself. So tune in for that. In a couple of weeks, we'll be talking about pharmaceutically bioengineered food crops. And if all works out well, in 3 weeks, we'll have someone from Theocracy Watch to talk about the burgeoning theocracy here in the U.S. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for listening.